go again. This is Bob Brundage, and today we're in East Hampstead, New Hampshire, at the home of Jim Mayo. Unfortunately, Jim's a little incapacitated today, and having thrown his back out a couple days ago, trying to catch one of the speakers off the speaker stand. And so we're, the date, by the way, is November the 19th, 1996, and we're very anxious because we have such an luminous dignitary with us today that we're anxious to learn more about Jim Mayo. So Jim, tell us a little bit about square dancing and a little bit about life before square dancing and how you got involved in one thing and another.
Well, there wasn't much life before square dancing for me. I started square dancing when I was in high school. Turns out my sister was working in Dublin, New Hampshire, and discovered that there were square dances, and she sent an emergency call home to my parents and said, send the kid up, I need a partner. That's how I got taken to my first square dance with Ralph Page.
There you go.
And found that it was fun. So I danced all that summer, and then we kept on dancing for a while through the winter. It's a little harder to get there during the winter, and I had just gotten my driver's license. But I danced fairly regularly to Ralph for a couple of years. Went off to college, and in my freshman year at Yale, the outing club was losing its square dance caller. He was graduating that year, and so they looked around to see if they could find somebody that knew how to dance. They said, Mayo, why don't you learn to call during the summer? Happened that I was working in Dublin, and Ralph had a Square Dance Institute. One afternoon he was going to teach people who wanted to try calling. So my first calling was to Ralph Page's orchestra with Crooked Stovepipe.
There you go.
And learned the dance. Ralph coached me a little bit. Then when I went back to college, I found a fellow from New York State who had done a little calling himself, and he and I together did most of the calling for the outing club parties for the next 3 years.
Great. Where was it you were born, brought up, though?
Dick was last night.
That was last night.
Born in Nashville, New Hampshire, just
there.
20 miles east of, or west of here.
Okay.
Lot up there, actually. I was born in Framingham, Massachusetts, but moved when I was very tiny to Nashville. And that's where I spent my childhood.
Right. So we're talking now about you finished college, you went to Yale, and tell us what happened after that.
Went into the Army. It was the Korean War at that time, and I volunteered. Turns out my destiny was to go into the automobile business with my father, but I figured if I volunteered, I could get some control over what happened to me.
Right.
Don't know whether that worked or not, but I spent the whole tour of 21 months at Fort Dix in New Jersey.
Okay.
There, finally managed to persuade the service club that they should let go of the old codger that was calling square dances for them and use a young whippersnapper from a company that was right on base there.
Yeah.
Took a while to get them to pay me. I think I worked 6 months for nothing. Finally, they paid me $5 a night.
There you go.
It was fun because I got to be a positive whiz at the first night of class because it was a training base. And they let the troops out to go to the service clubs in the sixth week of training. So each week I had a brand new crew of guys.
There you go.
The girls were all the same because they were the USO volunteers and they came over from Trenton. But I got to do a first nighter every night for about 18 months that I was there for
Well, that's great. So that long lasted, what did you say, 21 months?
21 months. Right. Came out of there in 54, came back home to go into business with my father in the automobile business.
Right.
Took me 9 months before him out of business.
Come on.
Just about true. Looked at the automobile business at that stage, and the companies were urging dealers to lie to their customers about the price so that they could jack up the resale value of the what they offered for used cars.
Right.
And my father decided he didn't want to be that dishonest.
Uh-huh.
And so we went out of the business. But while I was there, we started the Allman 8s in Manchester, New Hampshire in 1955.
Okay. And are they still dancing?
Allman 8s just stopped dancing this year.
Oh, there you go.
I called for them every other week for 30 years until 1986 when I left to go away on a 5-month trip, and they got another call to take my place there.
Right. That's got to be some kind of a record.
Fairtown Square has just shut down, and they gave me a plaque saying I've been calling for them for 29. So
there you go. Well, so you've had vast experience along that line with the local clubs. Many of the national, so-called national callers that I talked with didn't have too much of a home program, but I know you did have.
Oh, I did. Yeah. I called when I first started working for MIT. I was then calling 260 nights a year,
right,
along with my full-time job, and was calling for 3 clubs and teaching 3 classes.
There you go.
It was pretty much every night of the week.
Yeah, I guess so. And twice on Sunday.
Sometimes.
Right. So, well, you've had affiliation with a lot of different people. I know you've conducted caller schools, and I think somewhere in your resume there, and you call it not a resume, but a sheet that you did for the New England Hall of Fame presentation about your past history. And so we're going to save us the problem of transcribing all this information, and it certainly is very interesting. So tell us about some of the earlier big events that you got involved with before you started to go national.
Well, in fact, I never really did go national. I became known to the national callers because New England was a very popular place for them to travel.
True.
And as they came through, Joe Casey and I had started the Tri-State Callers Association, and we arranged for many of these callers to come and talk to Tri-State and share with us their experience. But in the process, many of the callers who did travel stayed at our house, and I got to know them quite well.
Right.
And that's really the basis for me being known nationally. I've always had a full-time job along
right.
with my calling, so I couldn't do the kind of touring that most of the nationally known callers did.
Right.
I did manage to do some traveling for the company, and then could usually get in touch with callers that I knew. They would let me call for their club or arrange a date. I used my vacations to travel,
right,
largely to become known in the nation, but I never got to do the kind of traveling that usually establishes a reputation.
Right.
But I did get to know most of the callers who were traveling.
Right.
In those days, a caller could come into New England and call 3 Saturday nights at the barn.
Right.
At the barns.
Yeah.
The Newton Pavilion and Bay Path Barn and Hoagie's.
Square Acres.
Square Acres.
Right.
And the Canoe Club.
Yeah.
If they worked 3 Saturdays, they could fill every day in between with club calling dates.
Sure.
So it made a very popular place, and most of the callers who did travel came through New England every year.
Yeah.
Usually they stayed at my house for a couple of days, and we got to be good friends with most of them.
Right. Now that's great. So how about the New England or Atlantic Convention?
I was there at the first one.
There you go.
Along with your brother.
Yeah.
Were you there?
I was there.
You were there.
That was when we had live music.
That was in the days when we in New England, at least, were in transition between traditional dancing and
true
and modern dancing. And,
true.
Ralph Page and Al and you and were all there, along with Ed Gilmore.
Yeah.
And that was an interesting period, trying to distinguish between of traditional and what we now know as modern square dancing.
Right.
The line was not as clear in those days.
Right. I guess everybody knows that Ralph Page was not particularly fond of the direction that square dancing was taking at that time.
Ralph was not at all enthusiastic about my shifting over from traditional into the,
right,
the modern approach to things. He thought I'd gone to the dogs. I find as I get older that I understand his attitude,
sure,
more and more as I look at the things that we've given up,
right,
in that transition into modern square dancing. We lost a great deal. We gained some things, but I'm afraid we paid too dear a price.
Right. So, all right, let's talk about Call Lab. You were one of the initiators of the Call Lab.
Well, yes, and largely because of the fact that I knew the Hall of Fame callers,
right,
from their travels in New England. When they were setting up this, the first meeting was just Hall of Fame callers.
Right.
The second year, the second meeting that they had, they each invited somebody else. And,
right,
and I think it was Al that invited me to come to that meeting.
Right.
So I was there from the second meeting of the founding,
yeah,
group.
Yes.
On through. Interesting, when they finally did get it established and had the first convention, they were sitting around the room trying to decide who was going to be the chairman.
Right.
And I believe that the reason they picked on me was that I was the only one in the room that wasn't a threat to any of their jobs. Since I wasn't traveling,
right,
they weren't going to do much to increase my taking of traveling dates by making me chairman.
I see.
And, it was sort of by default.
Right. Well, any thoughts about the during what happened during the formation of Collar Lab?
It was a wonderful experience to watch callers begin to work together.
Right.
We were not, any of us, a trusting lot in those days. Most of those callers who were best known at the time were independent businessmen. They had not had much experience, if any, with working in organizations.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of compromise wasn't foremost in their minds. They were independent people who, if they wanted to do something, did it.
Yeah.
And that had always worked for them. Here we were asking them to give up something for the good of the activity and the future of square dancing, and it was not behavior that came easily to them.
Right.
I remember particularly the day that we were talking about Frank Lane's calling snapperoo. He'd always,
right,
used the term snapperoo for star throw.
Right.
And the group was chiding him, saying, "Frank, why don't you get in with the rest of us here and give up that silliness?" At the time, we had just invented the term trade by.
Okay.
But Marshall Flippo was very reluctant to give up barge through,
okay,
which was a half square through and trade by.
Right.
Frank turned to Marshall and he said, "Marshall, I'll quit calling snapperoo when you quit calling barge through."
Okay.
Marshall said, "It's a deal." And they both did.
Okay.
One of the earliest stages of compromise.
Right. So let's continue. The telephone rang, or interrupted by Jerry Junk, and had a little conversation. So let's continue.
Color Lab business always takes priority.
That's right. So, all right, now we're got involved in Color Lab, and things are going along great.
I've been involved in square dance organizations.
Okay.
Since the earliest days. Well, I was, by inclination, an administrator.
Okay.
With my work at MIT was as an administrator, administrative assistant. And so organizations have always been a fascination for me. I've enjoyed them, and I joined with Joe Casey to start a callers organization, our local College Organization, Tri-State College, and I was one of the founding members of the New England Council of Caller Associations, and was also a founding member of CallerLab. I had believed that square dancing would benefit from organized activity on the part of callers since my earliest involvement. I've been interested in caller training and in the organizations of square dance callers. It's that that has been perhaps my most important focus, aside from the actual calling.
Right. Okay. And you've been associated with many other national leaders, too. You've been heavily involved in caller schools. And you want to tell us any comments about these?
Well, I got started teaching callers soon after I got started with the clubs in my home area here. Realized that I had used up all the free nights that I had, and if we were going to expand square dancing at all, we'd going to have some more callers. So I started what you might call a, not a floating crap game, but a floating caller school.
Right.
I was running a Sunday, third Sunday workshop at the Hayloft in Chester, New Hampshire, and I started teaching callers in a school in the evenings after those workshops. And it never started, it never ended. The caller wanted to learn to call, he came.
Right.
We did it the third Sunday every month for almost 10 years.
Right.
Many of the most respected callers in the northeast, in this part of the north of Boston area of New England, came out of that school. And I realized as soon as I started teaching it that I needed a textbook, and there weren't any. So I wrote a textbook,
okay,
which I published in 1966.
Right.
Well, there's 50 copies of it, and I still got two of them. I don't have any idea where the others went, but it was, I think, the first textbook that was ever published,
right,
that was directly intended to be a handbook or a text for people wanting to learn to call.
Right.
Others had done a lot of choreography and stuff, but this was an early one, and that work continued as I was one of those who helped develop the CallerLab accreditation program for caller coaches. And I have taught caller schools all over the country and all over the world. It's been one of my true loves in calling. I like to teach, and I like particularly to teach callers.
Right. And this is still ongoing. In other words, you have other caller schools on the agenda, I'm sure.
Oh, yes. I'm doing one next summer with Tony Oxendine out of Georgia. I did one last summer with Al Stevens and Chris Kindle in Germany.
Right.
I expect that I can keep on teaching callers as long as I can get around. Assuming my sore back will get better.
Right. What about national conventions?
I went to a few national conventions, but I became disappointed with, in my years as chairman of CallerLab, we tried to get the National Executive Committee to let us work with them to make the national convention a better event, to deal with the problems that they were having in programming and in sound.
Mm-hmm.
And they essentially told us to take our marbles and leave them alone.
Okay.
At that point, I became very discouraged with the attitude of the National Executive Committee. I retain that discouragement to this day because, in my view, they have been taking money out of the square dance activity in substantial chunks for a number of years, and to my knowledge, have never done anything that benefits the activity other than to run their convention.
Right.
And I think there are several problems in the way they run their convention.
Okay.
So I stopped attending.
Have you done any teaching of round dancing? Or?
I was a round dance teacher. I ran a round dance club.
Right.
Until, again, I got so busy that I couldn't keep up both ends of it.
Right.
But I queued and called.
Right.
several of my clubs up until 15 years ago, I guess.
Well, that was the trend at that time. The callers expected the cues.
Yes.
Right. And many of the dancers were expected to memorize the round dances, too.
I'll never forget one dance that I called, must be 20 years ago now, in Seattle. I often on my vacation set up rather long-range tours, but in this one I was calling a Sunday afternoon association dance in Seattle, and they gave me a stack of round dance records. So these are the rounds, you just put them on between your tips.
Yeah.
So I ended my first tip, and putting away the records, the guy came running up and said, put on the round dance. So I put the round dance on, and immediately the floor was full. Almost every one of the 40 squares of people that were there was on the floor doing the round. No cues, and I set the needle back to start them over again. So don't do that. Just put the needle on. And for the rest of the afternoon, I would take my record off, put their record on, put the needle down, and then put my record away.
Yeah.
And almost everybody danced that entire afternoon's round dance program without a word of cue.
Isn't that thing? Very interesting. How about contra dancing?
Well, I did contras for a long time and cued them in my early club programs. I didn't realize that contra wasn't going to be part of modern square dancing.
Right.
And so they were in the early days of my clubs, but again, the interest in square dance variety overtook the contra program, and so while I dearly love to dance them, I not had the opportunity, and I don't call them very often these days, but I enjoy doing it when I can.
Right. Is there any association with the line dance type of thing in the square dance clubs here, as there are in some areas?
Very little in New England. Our callers are pretty much of one mind that mixing line dancing in with square dancing is not a benefit to square dancing.
Okay.
We did in the early days have line dancers like Amos Moses, where it was part of the square dance. We did it as a round, as one of the rounds in the program. But when it came back in its own entity, we felt that it was a competitor for our customers. And I heard an interesting observation by Al Motti just this past weekend. He noted that in the early days of square dancing, many of our recruits came because of the women wanted to come dancing, and they brought their men with them. Now those same women go and line dance by themselves and leave their men at home.
Yeah.
And that certainly doesn't help us to fill our square dance classes.
Right. So, and I wanted to ask you also about recordings. Have you done some recordings?
Well, I've done a lot of recordings over the years. I've never really set out to do very much, but one of my early friends in the activity was Bruce Johnson.
Right.
Bruce was the production manager for Sets and Order and for McGregor.
Right.
And so he really helped me to steal a concept from your brother. My first recording, probably the most popular one I ever did, was Best Things in Life Are Free.
Okay.
And I did it because I had learned to love the music from Al's recording on Alamar.
Right.
But that tune became pretty much a standard, and is still in regular use. Bruce then started Pulse Record Company, and I made a couple of records for Pulse. Then Frank Lane got me to do a couple of records on Dance Ranch.
Right.
And I think I did one on TNT.
Okay.
And then McGregor just recently started up again, and McGregor. I think that's all the companies I've recorded from.
Right.
Most recently, just about a year ago.
Okay.
Beautiful piece of early McGregor music. Let Me Call You Sweetheart.
Okay.
It was just released this past June.
Okay, well, I had a couple other questions on recording, but I think we can skip those. What about hobbies, Jim? I know you.
I'm a square dance caller.
Yeah, right.
If you're a square dance caller and have a full time job, you don't have a lot of time for other hobbies.
Right.
But I've been an avid skier longer than I've been a square dance caller.
There you go.
I still ski regularly.
Yeah.
One of the joys of reaching the age of 65 in New Hampshire is that the state owns two very nice ski areas, and you can ski midweek free of charge if you're 65 and a resident.
Wow. Okay.
So I take advantage of that. Again, being retired, I no longer ski on weekends.
Right. Are the ski facilities fairly close to here?
Well, Sunapee is about an hour and 20 minutes from here.
Okay.
Cannon Mountain is about 2 hours.
Yeah. Well, that's really great. Do you get free ski lift, too?
Yep.
Yeah? Wow. That's better than the golfers have out in Albuquerque.
Yes, absolutely.
So, let's get a little profound. What do you feel is the appeal to college square dances? What do you find appealing about college?
Well, interesting. It may have changed some over the years. Clearly, when I started, I remember very clearly thinking, I can't do this because I'm not a singer. And clearly, you have to sing. It looks very complicated, like auctioneering, and I probably can't do that either. But once I got into it, I think the thing that drove me most in the early days was the opportunity to help people have a good time. In the earliest days of my calling, there wasn't any of what we know as choreographic puzzle. One memorized the whole routine like a poem and called it the way you memorized it. So there wasn't any of the puzzle-solving chess game type of thing that some callers find fascinating. But the whole game was to let people have a good time. And it was very clear that square dancing was something that people enjoy. That's certainly what got me started in it, and it still is a major part of my interest. But I also found that I could sing. I like to sing. It gives me the opportunity to make music.
Right.
And I also like to see people dance. So maintaining the feel of dancing that square dancing has to offer is one of my personal goals and personal satisfactions, to not only provide choreographic variety, but also to provide it in time with the music. Is very rewarding. But it's also been true that I've been able to travel a great deal through my square dance.
Right.
And that has been pleasant also.
This has been a very interesting conversation, and I've been asking everybody I've been interviewing, where do you think square dancing has been? Where do you think it is? Where do you think it's going?
Well, it's interesting to look back over the now 50 years since I started dancing.
Right.
When I started dancing, we had only traditional square dancing here in this area.
Right.
I guess even Al had gotten to modern in 47. I pace his involvement in modern square dancing from the Patty Shaw Conference, which I think took place in 49.
Okay.
But before that, we were doing traditional square dancing in which the calls were all memorized. The dance didn't change.
Right.
From one night to the next, or from one year to the next.
Right.
And I danced as a teenager with Ralph Page 3 nights a week, all summer long. I did that for several years. Loved every minute of it. There was hardly ever a word changed in his entire evening's program. We danced the same thing over and over again. But we danced it to live music. We danced it on the beat. It was unthinkable that a call should be given other than prompted for the phrase of the music.
Right.
And the sense of dancing that was part of the activity was overriding. Clearly, we did not have what we know today as choreographic challenge, not even choreographic variety. We danced different patterns, but everybody knew the whole pattern. If Ralph had stopped calling, it wouldn't have stopped the dance a bit. But we then discovered, and I don't know who did this, I've often thought it was Ed Gilmore, but discovered that you could change the call. And that people could, in fact, hear the change and react to it. I've personally attributed that to the development of sound equipment that was good enough so that people could, in fact, hear the call.
Right.
And as soon as that became available, right after the Second World War, it became possible to change the square dance figure. That marks, in my mind, the advent of modern square dancing.
Right.
I was in a development of it, the beginnings of it here in New England, and as a young, eager, just-starting caller, the idea of creating dance patterns was very intriguing.
Right.
That we could call three different routines in the same to the same piece of music was a novel idea that really grabbed me.
Yeah.
I ran eagerly into it.
Right.
Al was doing it with his Connecticut club. Because I was there in New Haven, I got to see it at work and to experience it as a dancer. And it continued to grow. Even then, maybe only in New England, I don't know about the rest of the country, but certainly here, we tried very hard to keep the music involved still.
Right.
We varied the choreography, but we also managed to prompt, call it, one of the striking things that everybody who came to New England commented on was the Alamo-style figure.
Right.
And rattle the rafters, and every dancer's foot hit the floor at the same time, because
right.
it was never called off the phrase.
Right.
That was a way of dancing that was, I guess, from all I've heard, uniquely New England. It certainly was one of the things that became a part of my own sense of dancing. But then somewhere, we began to really invent choreography. Before that, we had memorized routines, and we put them together. So the dancers didn't know which one we were going to use next, but they were memorized routines. And we got the dancers through them often by walking them through the routine before we called it.
Right.
That was common into the 60s. Somewhere in between the middle 60s and the middle 70s, sight calling, or the mental image, call it the slot system, freed up callers so that they could, in fact, genuinely create choreography. I know Les Gotcher thinks he invented sight calling. I'm not so sure I agree with that. But whoever did it, it changed square dancing forever. When callers became able to change the choreography or to create it as they went along. Unfortunately, what happened at the same time was that we lost this close connection with the music. We were so busy inventing the choreography that we couldn't do that and maintain the feel of the dancing, the sensuous side of square dancing.
Right.
And square dancing, as an activity, has always, in my mind, had three important characteristics. The sensuous, the feel of moving with the music, the sociability, the chance to work as a team with other people, and the intellectual, which was added to it somewhere in this 1960-1970 period, where solving the choreographic puzzle became important. My personal view is that during that period, we overemphasized, almost to the point of ignoring the other two, but we overemphasized the intellectual side. We held up the dance puzzle, the choreographic puzzle, as the most important aspect of the activity. And that, to my mind, was the beginning of the end. We gave away two very important appeals, the sociable and the sensuous aspects of our activity, and concentrated our attention exclusively on the intellectual puzzle solving, which surely was fun. It was fascinating. I enjoyed it as much as anyone,
right,
as a dancer and as a caller. I learned to sight call, and I loved the fact that I could create dance puzzles. And then one day I looked out on the floor and realized that while I was enjoying my puzzles, there were a lot of people standing around trying to figure out what to do next. And I began then to pay attention to how successful the dancers were. I'm afraid that it took a long time for callers in general to notice that the people they were calling for were not being very successful. The consequence of that is that we have attracted out of society a group of people who are indeed fascinated by the choreographic puzzle. These people enjoy the challenge of solving the puzzle,
right,
and minimize the importance of the sociable and sensuous aspects. We no longer worry about the phrase. In fact, most callers take the first beat of the phrase for themselves,
right,
and start their command on the first beat of the phrase,
right,
which guarantees the dancers never get it, or at least if they do, it's an accident.
Right.
Most callers will tell you, well, we can't maintain the choreographic variety if we pay attention to that phrase, and I think that's hogwash. I believe if even a modern caller gave the dancers the first count of the phrase for the first step, they would get it much more often throughout the rest of the dance than they do if the caller takes it for himself on the first phrase.
Right.
But all of that as it is, I see a continuum available in modern square dancing, even today. We have, all the way from the traditional, which in New England is a thriving activity, there are a number of successful traditional dance programs,
right,
going now. There, the content of the dance is primarily sensual. It is moving with the music. The dance routines are not changed. The callers call them pretty much the same way each time. And the intellectual end of that continuum is non-existent. From there, you go all the way to the other end, the challenge program, with its own 400 or 500 calls. I've done it 86 varieties of each one.
Right.
And there, it's rare to see any of what I would call dancing. I'm told there are groups that can solve these puzzles and dance at the same time, but I've never seen one. The groups I see are ones who scramble from one place to the next and then wait for the next call. And they scramble to the next place. And that's also fun for them. They're obviously having a good time. They go regularly. They enjoy. I see that as the other end of the continuum. And most of modern square dancing falls somewhere along the line between those two. My personal feeling is that we have moved too far toward the intellectual challenge end of that continuum with most of modern square dancing today, and that in the process we have paid little, if any, attention to the sensuous end of it. The sociability is not much under the control of callers, although surely we can influence it, but most of the sociability aspect of the activity has been turned over to the clubs. They're the ones who decide whether people are enjoying, are having a sociable time and enjoying each other.
Right.
My hope is that we will some they soon realized that we could appeal to a much larger audience if we moved back toward the sensuous end of this continuum and changed the balance so that we were not so heavily concentrated on the intellectual aspects of the activity, and rather made available to potential future dancers the full three-pronged appeal of sensuous, moving with music, dancing, sociable, teamwork together, the chance to shake hands and smile at each other as we dance, and along with it, choreographic variety, but always with the condition that to enjoy the puzzle, one must be able to solve it.
One of the comments that come up following that from quite a few of the people I've interviewed seems to be that that would be great, except we probably can't do it with our present day dancers. We can never ask them to switch from this intellectual aspect back to the sensual, and we may have to do it with all new dancers.
I think not only new dancers, but also new callers.
Right.
I think most of the callers we're calling today have come to our activity, come into it, understanding only the intellectual challenge side of square dancing. That's
true.
All that they've ever seen.
True.
Few of them have ever experienced good dancing, the sensuous, moving with music, dancing
right
to the phrase, taking one step for each beat of the music.
Right.
If callers have not experienced it, they surely are not going to be the leaders in making it available to future dancers.
Right.
My personal campaign now as a caller coach is to try to persuade new callers not to go into the club calling business, but to stay rather with starting new groups, doing one-night stands, concentrating on making dancing available and recruiting a whole new group of people. And if they do, never tell them about modern square dancing.
Right.
I don't think we can keep it a secret, but pretty soon it may fall of its own weight. It's pretty well observed that most of the people who are involved in today's modern square dancing are senior citizens, to say the least.
Right.
And it may be that they won't interfere if new groups started in new towns. Time will tell.
Right.
Square dancing will never die. Square dancing is too much fun to die.
Right. Some people are thinking that costuming has an influence on this activity. Some people are saying, you know, the young people look at these square dance dresses and say, boy, you'll never get me into that kind of a thing. Or older people who are a little overweight or something say that they will never. How do you feel about costumes?
I think costuming has not been a major problem for us. On the other hand, I don't see any reason for us to insist on costumes for dancing. When I started, we didn't wear costumes.
Right.
We wore comfortable clothes.
Right.
We did kind of like long-sleeve shirts. That was made clear, but full-circle skirts, or in those days, women didn't wear slacks.
Right.
Certainly out in public. So we didn't have costuming to start. Many of those that I've talked with who clamor about the costuming, about wanting to maintain the costuming, don't realize that it's a creation certainly within the last 30 years.
True.
So if it went away, I wouldn't cry. There too, I think if we let it go with those who enjoy it, today's society says that all the standard dress taboos have gone away. There's no reason why we can't let that happen in square dancing also. In my own groups, without me ever having said anything, the people who dance to me on Wednesday in a workshop come in street clothes. But when I have a dance on Friday night, they all come in square dance clothes. We don't have any rules. I don't ever say that you have to dress.
Right.
That just happens.
Yes.
But if we don't make rules and let people come as they will, I don't see that as a problem for students.
Well, you mentioned encouraging new callers to do more one-night stands and so forth. Do you have any secrets for this recruiting problem that Square Dancing has today?
We have some clubs in New England that have been very successful and continue to be successful. Just this past Sunday at Callers Association meeting, I heard about the Litchfield Swingers that have 33 people in their class. And the Concord coach, Concord, New Hampshire, had over 30 people in their class. How do they do it? We asked. And the answer was the old-fashioned recruiting ways. Every club member gets a postcard. They have to list the names of five people that might come. Then the executive committee goes and makes telephone contact with all of those people. And if they fail to show up the first night of class and they get a telephone call the next week, it's hard work. But where the clubs are willing to recruit, that works. If you ask about the one-night stand business, one of the newer callers in this area, Chris Pinkham, believed me when I encouraged him to try the one-night stand business along with his club calling. And he went to the camping show in Manchester last spring and went around to each of the campgrounds that had a booth there and said, I'm a square dance caller. I could provide you with an entertaining program at your campground. He booked every single Saturday night for that summer at that camping convention. And he has now booked Saturday and Friday for next summer with those same campgrounds because they had so much fun doing his one-night stand square dancing that they came back and said, can't we have another night? And he said, Saturdays are gone, you have to take Friday. And they took Friday. So square dancing is a popular product, which can be marketed if somebody's willing to work at it. But if all you want out of square dancing is to make challenging puzzles, you won't be a one-night stand caller.
Right. Yeah. I remember way back a number of years ago, one of the callers came into the activity, came in through the club program and the class program, and he had a chance to do a one-night stand, and he got there and he discovered that he didn't know how to call a one-night stand. In fact, a fella told me back in Albuquerque before I left for this trip that he attended another fellow's one-night stand, and he had to teach square through before he could use a singing call.
Yeah. There are a number of people who do that in their square dance classes these days. That's unfortunate. You got a guy down in Connecticut, Jack, and I forgot his last name, who does only one-night stands. He used to be a club caller many years ago and gave it up with him, the one-night stand business.
Yeah, there's quite a few around. Hal Fetschke.
And this guy came to our caller school. Was calling over 290 one-night stands a year. And his income from that was more than the entire income of the four callers on the staff of the school combined. There's a message there which some new callers are beginning to understand. Out of that could come a rebirth. And it's going to be callers with that attitude that rebuild our activity.
And that ability to maintain.
Yes.
Hello.
Hi, Stan.
Look at me. Look at my eyes.
Oh, boy. You got a little cold working, have you?
No, I think I'm...
So one of the things we want to be sure to mention before we get to the end of this tape is that you have several awards that should be mentioned and put on the record. Number one, the Setzenoder Hall of Fame. You're one of those, 35. And you also received the Milestone Award from Color Lab. You also received the Yankee Clipper Award, which is a New England-wide award, and the New England Hall of Fame also. And that I want to be sure we have that on tape so that we save it for posterity. Jim, I want to really thank you for taking the time. I'm sorry you're having a little problem with your back, but I'm sure that'll clear up in a in a couple of months or something.
Hopefully in a couple of hours.
I hope so, right.
At most a couple of days.
Right. So, Jim, thank you very much for your time and effort and your hospitality, and we'll look forward to seeing you here and there. See you out of Carlisle, but nowhere else.
I certainly appreciate the program that you're doing here and the fact that somebody is out getting on tape the experiences and wisdom of those of us who have been in the activity a long time.
Right.
Your own family's been involved as long as any of them, I'm sure.
Right.
And it's nice to know that somewhere, at least, these records will exist. I've been concerned as I've seen some of the longtime leaders who are no longer available to us, wishing that this project or one like it could get accomplished. And I want to thank you for undertaking to do it and making your time and resources available to get it all on tape.
Well, good.
I'm pleased to have been a part of it.
Good. Thank you, Robert.
Yeah.